Well, it's good to be with you today. My wife and I have enjoyed worshiping with you for some time now. We always enjoy coming to hear your pastor preach, and it is a pleasure to stand in this place. I know that many of you, most of you, came expecting to hear Dr. Brown preach today. Get over it. He's not going to be here. I do understand what it's like to come to church expecting to hear your pastor, and then, alas, you discover there is a pinch hitter. As your pastor said, I was dean of the School of Divinity at Gardner-Webb, and spent most Sundays out somewhere preaching. I was invited to preach at another First Baptist Church in the mountains here. My wife and I drove early on a Sunday morning. It was a morning like this. It was a little drizzle, maybe some freezing rain down at the university, but when we got up Saluda Grade up to the mountains, it had turned to snow. We got to the church, and I always like to arrive a little early so that everybody will relax when the guest minister is there. My wife and I gathered under umbrella, scurried into the narthex where there. An usher greeted us warmly. He looked at us and said, "You folks visitors?" And I said, "Yes, sir, we are." He said, "Well, you picked a bad Sunday to come, I can tell you." Well, I thought I knew what he meant, but I decided to give him the benefit of the doubt. I said, "Well, it is raw, rainy, cold." "No, that's not what I mean. No, you don't understand." He said, "The preacher is gone, and some fesser down there at the college is going to be preaching for us today." Oh, yeah. True story. And then he looked at me and rolled his eyes and said, "That ought to be rich, you know, like that." And then he said, I still can't believe he said this, but he said, "I tell you what, you look like nice folk. If you want to turn around and go right back to where you came from, nobody will ever know you were here. You got the day on me." I said, "Well, if it's all the same, we're already here, we'll just stay." He said, "Suit yourself," and handed us a bulletin. I walked in. Cheryl is punching me in the ribs, saying, "Why didn't you tell him who you are? You just let him dig a hole." And I said, "Well, I thought about it, but I have a better idea. When he sees me come out with the choir and realizes I'm the guest preacher and his eyes meet mine, he and I are going to have ourselves a moment." Well, we didn't make eye contact because he dove under the pew as I came in. So I understand what it's like coming to expect to hear your pastor and find out there's a guest preacher. I do know that. And I know that I don't know you, and you don't know me, and you don't care. And that's all right. That's okay. We have other work to do. Turn with me, if you will, in your New Testament to Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 15. We're going to read just one verse of Scripture. 1 Corinthians, chapter 15, just verse 58. I don't usually make a sermon of one verse. But it's justified in this case because this verse is a summary. It is a summary of everything Paul has said in the letter. The Word of God for the people of God. "Therefore, my beloved brothers," and I don't think Paul would mind if I added sisters, "be steadfast, immovable, abounding in the work of the Lord always, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Some years ago, I returned from First Baptist Church in Raleigh, where I was pastor. I had flown back to Kansas City, Missouri, where I had served in the 1980s on the faculty of Midwestern Seminary. I had been there for a number of years in the 80s. I had left to go back into the pastorate. I was invited back to teach a Doctor of Ministry seminar, which had been my seminar when I was on the faculty in the 80s. It was a good invitation. It was good to get back, see friends and colleagues and former students. There were 17 students in this particular seminar, some of whom had been students of mine in their Masters of Divinity work. So it was a joy to be with them. I got a chance to catch up on what had been going on in their lives since last I saw them. One of them, the brightest by far, most capable of the lot, asked me to go to lunch one day. That was not all that unusual, because students would do that generally to run a D-Min Doctor of Ministry project by me to get my feel or take on it. So I wasn't that surprised. So Jim and I went to lunch right across the street from the seminary there on North Oak Traffic Way. We enjoyed a delightful lunch. But in the middle of the lunch, he looked across the table and startled me. He said, "Dr. Stacy, I don't know what I'm doing here." Taking him to mean, I don't know what I'm doing in this seminar, because it was a demanding seminar, and I thought, well, you know, he's a busy pastor, and he's here for the week doing this seminar, and I'm sure he's feeling a little syllabus shock and academic overload. So being the pastoral type I am, I tried to reassure him, and I said, "Oh, Jim, you're a fine student. You'll be fine. You're doing well in this seminar." He said, no, you don't understand. It's not the seminar I'm referring to. It's the ministry. I don't know what I'm doing in the ministry." Well, I put my fork down. This was obviously going to be a little longer lunch than I thought. And I said, "Jim, nonsense. I've had you as a master's student. I've got you as a doctoral student. Now I've preached in your church. I've seen you at close range with your people. You're a fine pastor. You're loved and respected in your church. What are you talking about?" He said, "No, it's not that I don't know how to minister. It's that I don't think all this is ever going to amount to anything." I said, "All what?" He said, "Ministry." And then he started. He said, "You know, I spend all of my days engaged in the work of the church. I spend my hours trying to help people who are hurting and twisted and broken and confused. And all I have to work with, I mean, I have friends who go to work. I have church members who go to work, and they have tools, you know, tangible tools. If they're a plumber or an electrician or a surgeon, all I've got are my little preacher words. All I've got is the cross and the gospel, and nobody cares about that anymore." And then he said, "And then there's all that mind-numbing trivia with which I spend my days, copying machines that can sense when you're in a hurry. Endless committee meetings in which some verbal terrorist holds the committee hostage for 2 hours. And then all those prayers that I pray, those premarital counseling sessions where I'm trying to help them prepare for their life together in marriage, and I know they're not listening to me. They're not listening to anything I'm saying. And I know when I'm counseling, when I'm praying, nothing I do, nothing I say is going to matter." He said, "That's why I'm in the D-Men program." He said, "I thought maybe I could get my hands around some tools that would help me, you know, when in doubt, matriculate. And yet I'm in my last term of the D-Men program, and I'm feeling just as outgunned and overmatched and ill-prepared as I did the day I graduated with my Master's of Divinity." He said, "I'm thinking about quitting the ministry and going to law school, because there maybe I can help some people. Maybe I can do some good. And that's why I want to talk to you." I didn't have the heart to tell him. Just the week before in Raleigh, I had had lunch with a bright young attorney in our church who took me out to lunch to say, "You know, I'm thinking about resigning my law practice to go to seminary. Maybe there I can help people." Truth of the matter is, I know how he feels. I felt that myself. I can't tell you how many times I've stood beside the bed and heard a physician come in and say that ugly, ugly word, malignant. And I go home and tell Cheryl, I'm so sick and tired of death and dying, I think I'm going to scream. I prayed at courthouses and at bedsides and at cemeteries, sending up windy words that I'm not sure are going to make any difference, change anything. I do counseling sessions with people I know aren't listening at the time, and I've asked myself, what am I doing? None of this is going to change anything. They're going to die no matter what I say. They're going to divorce no matter what I do. That's why you'll forgive me, I trust, if I harbor the sneaking suspicion that Paul, in our passage for this morning, is engaging in a little bit of ecclesiastical bravado when he says, knowing that our labor in the Lord is not in vain. Now, I'm a New Testament scholar. I've spent my life studying the New Testament and much of my life studying Paul. And I can tell you, Paul spent a lot of his time wondering whether or not his labor was in vain. All you have to do is read his letters. Just read them. How can Paul say that? How can Paul say that in Corinthians? You know anything about this church? I mean, you think your church, other churches you know, have difficulties. This church was a basket case. They were polarized. They were divided. They were at each other's throats. They couldn't get along, suing each other in the public square, in the marketplaces. How can Paul say in this letter, knowing that our labor is not in... The truth of the matter is, Paul was not always as confident that his labor was not in vain as he lets on. I checked this week. I looked up how many times Paul used the phrase, your labor is in vain, or your labor is not in vain. 19 times in his letter, Paul will use that phrase. Knowing that our labor is not in vain, fearing that our labor has been in vain, we beg you not to accept the grace of God in vain. I'm afraid that I've labored over you in vain. Something of a Pauline preoccupation. Kept him up at night. Am I doing this for nothing? Apparently, Paul spent more time thinking about whether or not his labor had been in vain than he lets on. Paul, methinks thou protestest too much. Let me be honest with you today on the cusp of a brand new year. Being in the church, being in the ministry, for that matter, is no guarantee that you'll never experience discouragement. The story of the church does not begin once upon a time, and it hardly ever ends, and they lived happily ever after. Discouragement, even in the church, is a persistent suitor. We work, we pray, we believe, and yet sometimes it seems like nothing is happening. Nobody is listening. Nobody gets converted. Nobody gets changed. Nothing twitches. And we wonder, is our labor in vain? Has any of this helped? Has it mattered? Paul must have felt it. I know he felt it. How can Paul say, oh, I know. That your labor is not in vain. How can he say that? Well, truth of the matter is, he doesn't. That's not what he says. What he says is this: knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. In the Greek, when you want to emphasize something, you put it last in the sentence. And Paul will say, knowing that your labor is not in vain, to Kyrio, in the Lord. That's a world away. Let me tell you all the truth I know, which is never to be confused with all the truth. After 40 years of ministry, I think I'm convinced of only one thing about the ministry, and that is, we who are in the Lord's work, and that means you and me, We err mightily if we ever, and I mean ever, forget that the work we do in the Lord's work is the Lord's work and not ours. There's a serendipity. There's a surprise to ministry that can shock you and ambush you. A friend and colleague and mentor of mine, the late Dr. Fred Craddock of Emory University, tells a story about when he was a pastor of a small church in Tennessee going to hospital to make rounds, check on some members of his church. And in this little community in Tennessee, where there was no hospital chaplain, pastors took turns dropping in on people to see if they had needs that pastors could meet. And so Craddock was moving through the hospital ward, popping his head in, and he walked by this one room, and there was a woman in bed. She yelled at him, sir, are you a preacher? He said, yes, ma'am. Would you come in here? He comes in. She's in the bed. He looked at her and said, hello, my name is Fred Craddock. She said, well, would you come over by the bed and pray over me? He said, sure, I'd be happy to. What would you like me to pray for? And she looked at him as if he had lost his marbles and said, that I be healed, of course. And so Craddock bowed his head and took her by the hand and prayed a prayer that God would heal her. And he said, well, ma'am, I hope God blesses you today. He turned to leave, and she said, wait a minute. I feel kind of strange. I feel kind of tingly all over. And she started stretching a little bit in the bed, and finally she threw her legs over the side, put her feet in the scuffs, and stood up and jumped up and down, first on one leg and then on the other. And she said, you know, I feel wonderful. I feel better than I felt in years. Thank you, preacher. I'm healed. And she jumped out and hugged Craddock. Craddock left the room, walked out to his car, put the key in the ignition, and before he turned the key, he said a little prayer. He said, dear God, don't ever do that to me again. There's an ambush to ministry that can surprise us and take our breath away. Because the truth of the matter is, you don't know what's happening when it looks like nothing's happening. You don't have enough perspective to know. We're like characters in a play. We appear on stage for our little scene, and we read our lines, and then we leave. We don't know what happened on the stage before we got there, and we don't know what's going to happen after we leave. All we do is we just come on stage and say our lines and then leave. Truth of the matter is, we don't know if we're major characters or minor characters. Oh, we all think we're major characters, but we don't know. We may just be little bit players. We just come in and read our lines. As a matter of fact, we don't even know what act we're in. We don't know if we're in Act 1 or Act 6. We don't know. The author of the play may tell us someday. He may not. But what matters finally, what matters only, is that we play our part. We do our job. We read our line and leave the play to the author. When it's all said and done, and when the curtain finally comes down, the only thing that matters is when the curtain rings down, you are standing on your mark, delivering your line. Because you don't know. You don't know at all. Ruth didn't know. Ruth Whitford was my major professor in college. I was an English major. Ruth had done her PhD at Columbia University in New York. And then, you'll appreciate this, Dr. Brown, she did postdoctoral work at Magdalen College, Cambridge, wait for it, with C.S. Lewis. It was Lewis. It was through Ruth Whitford that I first, back in the early 1970s, was exposed to the writings of C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien and G.K. Chesterton and George MacDonald and Owen Barfield. She introduced me to all of their writings. She said, Wayne, you're going into ministry, and these are people who bring faith and literature together in beautiful ways. You need to know their work. I just read everything C.S. Lewis wrote, memorized most of it. Ruth was an amazing woman. Dr. Whitford would conduct her classes for her major. There was only about a dozen of us in there. We would sit in a circle with Dr. Whitford in the middle, and she would invite the greatest literary minds of the ages to come in and tell their stories. Mallory and Moliere, Tolstoy and Turgenev, Shakespeare and Spencer, one after the other. Not a note. She never used a note. She would just come in with her roll book, take roll, and then put that down and never pick up anything else. And then just one after the other tell these amazing literary stories. I loved her classes. I loved her. But I was a young preacher boy, and I was out most weekends preaching somewhere, doing youth revivals. That was in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and we were all doing youth revivals then. And I got busy. I had overbooked. And when it had come time for midterm that fall, I basically blew off the midterm. I had an A in the class, and I thought, well, this isn't going to matter if I finish the class with a B or even a C. It'll be all right. So I blew off the midterm. I'm sitting there that week, following that weekend after I had done my youth revival. Dr. Whitford comes by, and she's handing out midterm papers. She comes to my desk, and she puts the paper down, C-. And she whispered, and she said, Wayne, I had to look twice at this. I couldn't believe this was your paper. This was just not indicative of your work. I looked at her and I said, I shouldn't have said it. But I said, well, Prof, I didn't have time to study. I was out doing the Lord's work. She should have just backhanded me right on the spot and said, well, there's the Lord's work, you know. But she didn't. She leaned down and whispered so that nobody could hear. She said, might you come by my office after class so that we could have a moment's conversation? I died a very quiet death. Went by her office after class, sat down, books floor to ceiling. She looked at me and she said, Wayne, I don't know where you have gotten the idea that thinking is the enemy of faith, but it isn't. Do you remember what Jesus said? She said, when he was asked to sum everything up, he quoted the creed of Israel, the Shema, and then she quoted it in Hebrew. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. And then she said, but then he added to that Leviticus 19. And you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and soul and mind and strength. She said, did you hear that litany, Wayne? Heart and soul and mind and strength. But go back to Leviticus and look it up. Mind isn't in there. Jesus added it. Must have thought it was important. She said, I'm a Christian for two reasons. Because it makes sense and feels right. If it just made sense and didn't feel right, I wouldn't be a Christian. And if it just felt right but didn't make sense, I wouldn't be a Christian. I'm a Christian because it makes sense and feels right. Because in my Christian faith, Wayne, my head and my heart have become friends. Don't make them enemies. Be a thoughtful believer. Be a faithful thinker. Her words that day changed my life. I went out of there and I made a promise. As God is my witness, I will never disappoint that woman again. I went back years later to thank her for the impact that she had made on my life. She was still in that same office. I sat down. I told her that story about what she had done years earlier. And when I finished, I said, Dr. Whitford, you have made a profound impact on my life, and I wanted you to know that. She was very polite. She was very sweet. She listened to me finish. And when I finished, she looked at me and she said, "I'm sorry, you have me at a disadvantage. You see, I teach a lot of students. Now, who are you?" She didn't remember me. She didn't remember that conversation. I thought it was something about me that she thought was worth saving. No. No. She was just doing her job. She was just playing her part. It took some courage to do what she did. She crossed the line from professor to mentor and friend, inviting me to her office to straighten me out. That could have gone ugly. And there was a moment then, I could see it in her eyes, when she was thinking, "Should I do this? I mean, is he worth it? You know, I mean, stupid little ignorant freshman. Why am I wasting my time with him? I could be doing something important. I could be writing a book. I could be publishing an article. I could be grading some papers of some students who want. I could be having a root canal. Anything be better than this?" And she said, "Might we have a moment's conversation? Would you come by my office?" And she changed my life. You don't know what's happening when it looks like nothing's happening. When the curtain comes down, whenever that is, the only thing that matters is that you play your part, stand on your mark, and deliver your lives. Now, Paul, Ruth, and I have a gospel word for you. Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord, your labor is not in vain.